in Parashat Mas'ei. This is the shiur that the whole world reconnects. This Shabbos. At the end of Shabbos, everybody will be in the same place in Kriyat HaTorah. And until this Shabbos, in Chutz La'aretz, they were a week behind us. Right? This Shabbos, everybody, so that Dvarim is together. Everybody does Dvarim together. So this shiur is sponsored by friends of David Wicks, Zichrono Livracha, and his memory, Lilui Nishmat David, Ben Mordechash, and Zichrono Livracha. So I wanted, we are sort of stuck to Parshat HaShavua. And Parshat HaShavua takes a long time to get through the book of Bamidbar, and a long time to get through the book of Dvarim. It's hard to remember that the book of Bamidbar, the second half of the book of Bamidbar, starting from Pinchas, or the second part of Pinchas, until the end of Dvarim, all happened in no time at all. They were ready to go to Eretz Yisrael. Moshe Rabbeinu said whatever he said, then they went to Eretz Yisrael. But this took part of a half of Bamidbar, to tell this story, took half of Bamidbar, and all of the book of Dvarim. So during this time when they were getting ready to go to Eretz Yisrael, different things happened. But one of the things that happened was that there was an adjustment of the 12 tribes. Everybody knows, we all spoke about it from time to time, that the situation in the family of Avram and Yitzchak and Yaakov changed. Right? The situation changed. Avraham had two sons, but he could only bear one of them. He could only have one son. Right? And that one son, whose name was Yitzchak, became Avram's only son, even though he had many other children. Right, he had Yishmael, and then he had the children of his wife Keturah, which Chazal say also was that Keturah was Hagar. That Keturah was Hagar, but it didn't produce a family. Hagar was really not the mother of his children. He sent them away. They led a life of their own. And the inheritors, the family of Avraham Avinu, became Yitzchak. He was the son. Now the same thing, or something similar, happened to Yitzchak. He had two sons who were, I think we would call them twins, right? I don't know if they were fraternal twins or identical twins. I imagine, at least, you know, in my mind, it's hard for me to imagine that they would be identical. That would be annoying. So I guess the Chumash says that they didn't look the same. One was red and one was not. One was hairy and the other was not. So, but to have twins, you have twins with one mother. There's, I guess, no other way to do that. One mother produces twins. So you would think that would be a family. That'd be a family. The interesting thing is that Yitzchak actually tried to make it into a family. And when he was old and he wasn't able to function so well, he decided to give Esav a bracha. And you remember that story, right? He said to Esav, go and bring food, because this is in the Nefesh HaChaim, also says, is that food makes you more, it makes giving a bracha more appropriate. Like, if you do me a favor, I want to do you a favor. If you do something nice to me. So that's what Yitzchak said to his son Esav. Do something nice, and then I'll do something nice. His wife, Rivka, heard this and thought this was a terrible disaster. Whether Rivka was right or not is a matter, is open, right? You could think about it. Was she right? that Yitzchak didn't know what was going on, that Yitzchak wanted to give away a bracha to Esav that really should have gone to Yaakov? Or was it that Yitzchak knew that Esav was not the person who you could build the future on? Now, you can't make a future out of Esav, but he thought that he could bring him into the family. Of course, the end of the story. But this question is an important question, but it's not our parasha, right? The important question is, like, what was Yitzchak doing? Did he know what he was doing? Was he in favor of Esav becoming the primary inheritor of the bracha that was given to Abraham? To me, that's inconceivable pshat, so to speak. I can't even imagine it. So I think Rivka was mistaken. But how much was she mistaken? And why was it that Yaakov, who was an Ishtam Yoshev Ohalim, which the Gemara explains as being a Talmud Chacham, right? That's what he did. He learned Torah. How come he was willing to lie? And you remember when Yitzchak said to Yaakov, "Who are you? Who are you? What did he say? Anochi Esav Bechorecha. Anochi Esav Bechorecha." Which Rashi explains in a kind of a pretty amazing Rashi. Rashi says, Anochi, you have to read it this way, Anochi is Anochi, I am who I am. You know, like one of those Gertrude Stein lines. I am who I am, who I am. Ve'esav b'chorecha. Ve'esav b'chorecha. So according to Rashi, Yaakov didn't lie technically, because you could read the pasuk with a different niggun. You know that when you get when you read a play, you read the text of a play, it includes a niggun. You know, you say question, exclamation, terror. You know, like there are all these stage directions of how you're supposed to speak, because the words and the punctuation of those words are not sufficient in a play. So that's really what Rashi says. Like Rashi says, how do you know? How do you know what Yaakov said? There are no, they used to call them supra-segmental markings. You don't know whether he said it this way or he said it that way, whether he meant Anochi and then Esav b'chorecha. You don't know, so maybe he said that. So if you're committed, Rashi says, if you're committed to the idea that Yaakov is not going to tell a lie, which sort of is counter-indicated by the picture that we have of Yaakov. Yaakov was righteous and learned and studious, and he was sitting in the yeshiva of Sheva Eber. So we compare Yaakov to Talmidei Chachomim that we may have met, you know, recently, and we say it can't be. So here's Rashi, comes to save us, but Rashi could not save the fact that Esav felt as though he was done in, that he was sent away, no less than Yishmael was sent away. Except that because Esav was closer to Yaakov than Yishmael was to Yitzchak, right? Yishmael and Yitzchak, they had the same father but different mothers. So Yishmael, his father said to Yishmael, like, you go on your own, you know, become a rancher or something. So it was fine. He did that. But Esav felt that he had, after all, the same father and the same mother. And when they had the same father and the same mother, they said, you shouldn't be part of the inheritance. You shouldn't be sent away. But here Esav was sent away, actually. So Esav, again, Yitzchak was not capable of integrating Esav into the family, which is what I think that Yitzchak really wanted to do. Rivka said, it's hopeless, right? You know, when it comes to this, in the Chumash, In the Chumash, the women are more perceptive, right? Sarah was more perceptive about Ishmael than Abraham. Abraham was into the Baal Tshuva thing. And he says, oh, don't worry, we'll be nice, we'll give him food, give him a little cholt, he'll run around the house on Shabbos, and everything will be fine. And Sarah said, it's hopeless. So she was right. The same thing is true about Rivka. Yitzchak said, look, I'll take him in, I'll eat with him, I'll give him a bracha. Maybe he'll be chozer b'tshuva. After all, he has good genes. He comes from the same place that Yaakov comes from. Rivka knew that this could not work. Rivka knew, so I'm just saying that in the family context, you could say, you know, I don't like to say things that are too bombastic, but I like to be dramatic. So bombastic and dramatic are closely related. But as long as you know that, you can take it all with a grain of salt. These two examples seem to indicate that when it comes to matters of family, matters of family, that and the situation is hopeless, the women know that. The women in our stories knew the hopelessness of it. And the men, Avram Avinu and Yitzchak Avinu, they didn't know that. They thought that, Chazal say that Avram Avinu was the first kiruv worker. You know, he went around and he told, Vayita Eshel B'Be'er Sheva. So the Pasuk said that Avram Avinu would bring in people and tell them that they should say Birkat HaMazon and thank God for what they received, that in that way he would spread the idea. I mean, this idea of spreading the word that God was God and there was one God and only one God, this is something that is attributed to Avram Avinu. That not only, I mean, one of the chidushim of Avram Avinu was that he was not a philosopher. Philosophers could only talk to other philosophers. But people who are like mathematicians, I mean, they can talk to other mathematicians, they can't talk to anybody else. But Avram Avinu is described in Chazal as somebody who wanted to talk to everybody else, who wanted to make sure everybody else understood what he was coming from. So Avram Avinu was the first kiruv, was the first kiruv worker. And Yitzchak generally is described as following in the path of Avram Avinu, not perhaps about this specific matter, but in general. So the second family, the family of Yitzchak and Yaakov and Esav, could not maintain itself. It broke apart. It broke apart, for Chazal, the tension between Yaakov and Esav never ended. Never ended. Esav became Romi. Romi was the one who exiled us into the never-ending exile. I mean, you know, I don't mean never-ending, like we may not be in exile, but the Jewish people, many of whom are still in exile. That's Esau. So that's Yaakov and Esau. Yaakov, however, changes all of that. Because Yaakov had at least 12 sons. And even though we know that not all of the 12 sons acted in a reasonable manner throughout their lifetime, right? In spite of that fact, the notion of 12 sons was maintained, right? And so, in the beginning, the first pasuk of the book of Shemot, which you don't have on the sheet, it doesn't matter. I'll read it to you. It says, "Ve'ele Shemot b'nei Yisrael ba'im Mitzrayma et Yaakov Yishu Beitov ba'u." So the people who came down to Mitzrayim, Yaakov Yishu Beitov. Right? You remember this was not an easy thing to get Yaakov to Mitzrayim. It was difficult. It was difficult. That's a separate story, right? You remember when there was a famine? When there was a famine in the land, Abraham went to Mitzrayim. Abraham. There was another famine in the land, and Yitzchak also thought he should go to Mitzrayim because his father went to Mitzrayim. I mean, that was for, that was Yitzchak, that was the ultimate measure of things. His father went to Mitzrayim. So he thought he should go to Mitzrayim. He thought he should go to Mitzrayim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, no, Gur ba'aretz hazot, you stay here. And he went to the territory of the Plishtim, which was still in what we call Eretz Yisrael, the boundary of Eretz Yisrael, even though the Plishtim, as I mentioned before, the Plishtim were never conquered. The Plishtim were never conquered. So now you had these two models. There was the Avraham model and the Yitzchak model. Avraham went to Mitzrayim to get food, and Yitzchak didn't go to Mitzrayim, but went to Eretz Plishtim, where he was supported and got food. Finally, Yaakov, he had to go to Mitzrayim, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised Avraham Avinu that his children would be enslaved in Mitzrayim for 400 years, and then there would be the ultimate redemption. But Yaakov, you can see from the story, Yaakov didn't want to go. Yaakov didn't want to be part of that. He didn't think he would have to go to be part of the exile. But finally, through a series of miraculous events, which a person with a little bit of perception would say miraculous. I mean, you could say that they were natural, right? You know, Yosef becoming king, feeding the world, taking care of the brothers, sending them back, bringing father. You know, it was like pretty miraculous, even though each step of the way looked regular, looked like it could be understood as being regular, and therefore Yaakov withheld his approval. Now this, of course, comes after a split in the family. Just like Yitzchak and Yishmael, and then Yaakov and Esav, there's another split in the family between Yosef and his brothers. Right, Yosef's brothers, a split that was never completely healed. But somehow Yaakov manages to get them all back together again. Yaakov and Yosef work together. They get them all together. I mean, Yaakov, remember when Yosef had a dream, Yaakov didn't want to tell the other brothers what happened because he knew that it was true that there was some sort of malchut, kingship, that was going to be bestowed upon Yosef. And that's what actually happened. So there's a departure, and there's a new world. And the new world is that there's a family. And that the family, innocent, guilty, or whatever, the family remains a family. This is like the most radical change, but it was a necessary change in order to produce Klal Yisrael, in order to produce a nation. If you would have maintained the standard of Avraham Avinu, that everybody in Klal Yisrael had to be righteous, had to be like Avraham Avinu, we would have never gotten this business off the ground. Right, where there would not have been Am Yisrael. So Yaakov Avinu created Am Yisrael. How did he create Am Yisrael? He said, Reuven, I don't like what you did. Shimon and Levi, I don't like what you did. But you're in. Right? I'm talking about the brachot at the end of the book of Bereishit and Vayechi. Right? Those brachot. Reuven, he did what he did. Shimon and Levi did what they did. You're in. You're with me. I mean, I don't like it. I don't like what you did, right? Vayikach Korach ben Kos ben Levi. You know, so he didn't want, Yaakov didn't want his name to be mentioned. Okay. He did something wrong. He did something that was unexpected, but he was in the family. I think I'm describing like an Italian family or something. But it's only this principle, the family principle, which allowed Am Yisrael to be created. And so we get to the question. We get to all this introduction was introduction to the question. If you look at the sheet, right, Moshe Rabbeinu, this is our parasha, the parasha of Mas'ei. ויצב משה את בני ישראל לאמור, זאת הארץ אשר תתנחלו אותה בגורל, אשר ציווה השם לתת לתשעה מטות וחצי המטה. So you know that something happened. That Am Yisrael, which became a nation based on the two elements that made us into who we are, right? The one was the element of family, which the Torah calls progeny, like children. You have a lot of children. Obviously, if you have a lot of children and they don't stay with you, so you didn't have any children. So when HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Avraham Avinu, then to Yitzchak, then to Yaakov, you're going to have a lot of children, that means that the children will remain part of the enterprise, even if they are not always worthy. Right? That's what it means. That's what the pshat is in having a lot of children. It doesn't mean you'll have a lot of righteous children. It means you'll have a lot of children. How do I know it doesn't mean you have a lot of righteous children? Because of Reuven, Shimon, and Levi. Because I know that they weren't all righteous. Or that they did things, and the relationship between all of the brothers and Yosef. Yosef came out to be a star. So in the pattern of Avraham and Yitzchak, Yosef should have been the only one left. And it is interesting that Yosef's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, become tribes. I mean, you can explain that any way you want, but you see that Yosef was recognized as being something special compared to the others. Wanted to ask? No.
Binyamin was never, though, involved in any of the...
Wasn't born yet.
Right, so he wasn't involved in the sechsuch between the old brothers and Yosef. So
it's hard to say that there's a grand nature to being not born.
No,
I mean, you're talking about...
In other words, you could say that it was negative against the old brothers because they had to argue with Yosef, but there was no negative against Binyamin.
That's true, but there was not. But he wasn't in a state where, in a situation where there could be a negative. He was sheltered, but because of Yosef. He was sheltered because of Yosef. Yosef sheltered him.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what it says. It says in the pasuk, "Asher titnachalu otah begoral asher tziva Hashem v'teit l'tish'a hamatot v'chatzi hamateh." Eretz Yisrael is going to be divided between 9.5 shvatim. Now, nobody, the Gemara doesn't mention it, and the Mefarshim don't mention it, but it seems to me that this is a statement that reflects on the breakdown or break up of the family situation. The family situation, because everybody understands that Reuven, Gad, and then Chatzi Shevet Menasheh, who lived in Eva HaYarden Mizracha, the eastern side of the Jordan River, separated themselves from the rest of Klal Yisrael. They were no longer part, even though it's true in last week's parasha, we saw that Moshe Rabbeinu made demands on them. And they made an agreement, you have to go be the first ones to fight, and you have to go and help and capture the land, and after the land is captured, you come back to where you are. Yes, all of that is true. But once they came back to the land that they had originally captured, the land of Sichon and Og, they were in a different space. Because from the point of view of mitzvot ha-tluyot ba'aretz, which is the measure of Kibush Eretz Yisrael. The measure of Kibush Eretz Yisrael is not only that you get a place to live, you conquer Eretz Yisrael, have a place, but you also create obligations which are called mitzvot. Mitzvot atliot ba'aretz are a function of Kibush, of the conquering of Eretz Yisrael. But in Eva Yarden Mizracha, those rules do not apply. So if that's the case, that those rules do not apply, then I would say what they did, what Reuven and Gad, Chatzi Shevet Menashe did, I mean, after all, what was the purpose of this whole story? starting from Avram and Yitzhak and Yaakov and Yosef and going to Mitzrayim and coming back to Mitzrayim and going to Eretz Yisrael. What was the point? The point was to inherit the land which would obligate me to do these mitzvot. But to have land and not do the mitzvot seemed to be, at least for my narrow kind of yeshiva-based education, seemed to be kind of counter-indicated. So that you could say that these psukim reflect, these psukim reflect, he says, Kila kumate b'nei, pasuk yudal b'nei ruveni lebeit avotam, umate b'nei hagadi lebeit avotam, chazim atem menashe lakhu nachalatam. That Reuven got a chatzit shevi menashe, moved out of this sphere of Torah influence. They still learned Torah, and they did certain mitzvot that were connected to the land they were in, but it was not the same. It was not the same. Now this whole story came to an end this story about the family went through a radical change, because the family which Yaakov kept together, right? They were all together. They hated each other, but they were together. As long as Yaakov was alive, they didn't dare express their hate. And even though they were willing at first to kill Yosef, you remember Yosef went looking for them? That's also an interesting story. I mean, why did Yosef go? Why did he go to look for them? Why did Yaakov send them? I mean, after all, they all knew that this was a bad situation, that they didn't get along. So the world this idea of the two and a half tribes that are different, that are separate, was the beginning of the breakdown of the family, which consisted of 12 tribes. And that family was differentiated. That family was differentiated by the different people involved, who were not all of the same ilk. But you know that Yaakov Avinu, when he blesses his children in Mitzrayim, right, he blesses them as they were born. Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda. That's the order of the brachot that Yaakov gives out. So for Yaakov, there was still this kind of, the brachot was set up that way. But you know that when Moshe Rabbeinu gave the brachot in the parasha of Bezot HaBracha, when Moshe Rabbeinu gave out the brachot, he started with Reuven for some reason. I don't know why. I mean, we could try to guess, but who came after Reuven in Bezot HaBracha? Yehuda. Who is Yehuda? Like in history, never tell me what it says in Rashi. But who is Yehuda? Yehuda is the replacement of the 12 tribes. Yehuda becomes Am Yisrael, becomes the family. The family of Am Yisrael is called Yehuda. And the Romans called Eretz Yisrael, Eretz Yehuda. That's what they called it, because that's what was left. In 723 BCE, Sancheriv ended the idea of 12 tribes. He exiled the 10 tribes that lived north of Yerushalayim. He exiled them from Eretz Yisrael, and along with them exiled the 2.5 tribes who lived in Eva Yadein Mizracha. He exiled them as well. Was it the bicycle?
Not the bicycle. A suitcase.
Why, the suitcase that walks and talks?
Yeah. And one that fell down and I went flying after it.
Well, the bicycle is better. So Sancheirev put an end to the idea of the family, and you see that it's in Moshe Rabbeinu's bracha. Moshe Rabbeinu says Reuven and then Yehuda, because that's all there was going to be. That was what's going to be left. Okay, Yehuda got Malchus. All kinds of reasons. What I mean to say is, you see that in history there is the collapse of the idea that the family of Yaakov is made up of 12 tribes. Tribes distinguishing themselves one from the other, liking and disliking one from the other, and ultimately being replaced by Yehuda. Yehuda, now even though there was a memory, right? There was Binyamin and Shimon, right? Do you see the map? I always do this. I'm never quite sure if I get away with it. You see the map in front of you, map of Israel? Right, should I draw it over here? Here's a map of Israel. Here's the Kinneret. This is the Jordan River. And this is Israel. And here's Yerushalayim, right in the middle. Right, so the 10 tribes were basically north of Yerushalayim. But on the border between Yerushalayim and Ephraim, which is like a very big Shevet, on that border was the tribe of Binyamin. Binyamin was kind of very friendly with Yehuda in geography. And so Binyamin got absorbed. In the south of Yehuda, was another small tribe called Shimon. And they got absorbed. Until in the maps, it's all Yehuda. It's all Yehuda. There's no Binyamin. And no, it's only in the Gemara that Binyamin is left, because there was a problem about who owned the territory of the Beit HaMikdash. Was it Yehuda or was it Binyamin? Okay, it's like an interesting question. But you see that what happened was Yaakov Avinu created a family. But the family that he created was made up of tribes, of Shvatim. And those tribes, in order to distinguish themselves from each other, had to dislike each other to some extent. Otherwise, why would they be distinguished? In the desert, when they moved from one place to another, they camped. They had a very strict way of doing it. Three tribes on each side of a square, with the Mishkan, Ol Moed, in the middle. Right? So each set of three, they distinguished themselves. According to the Chumash, they had flags. And their flags had, you know, animals on them. Each tribe had their own flags. So that's what happened. That's what happened. The question is, a question might be, why did it happen? Why did it happen quite in this way? Why couldn't Yaakov had one son? Let's say Yosef, who went down to Mitzrayim for some reason, and then brought his father. And that would be the beginning of the story of Am Yisrael. Why did we need the 12 tribes, which eventually were wiped out? And you know that the exile of the 12 tribes is different than the other two exiles. Right? Remember, there are three exiles. We don't usually think of it that way. But there's the exile of the 10 tribes by Sancheirev in 722 BCE, maybe 723. I'm not good at dates. One of those dates is correct. Right? Sancheirev exiled the 10 tribes. Right? The northern 10 tribes, including Reuven, Gad, and Chatzi Shevet Menashe. The second Galut was what we call Galut Bavel, Nebuchadnezzar, 586 BCE. All he had were the Jews who lived in Eretz Yisrael. He exiled them. But they weren't called tribes anymore. They were all called Yehuda, whoever was there, whether it was Binyamin or Shimon originally, was all mushed together as Yehuda. And the third exile is the Galut Romi, which is going on till today, with, you know, the change of Medinat Yisrael, if you think about it in that way. Apparently you don't have to. So that why did you need the 12 tribes exactly? Why did you need this interlude with tribes in our history? I mean, what do we learn from that? What do we gain from that? So, here I am. Let's look a little bit at this on the obverse side of this sheet. There's this very long discourse by the Preet Tzaddik. I will just a little bit, which is this discourse on the parasha of Shemot is found in the Preet Tzaddik in the beginning of Shemot, right? The Preet Tzaddik of Tzaddik HaKohen of Lublin, right? Who I always say, you know, the great bracha was that he had no Hasidim, so he had a lot of spare time, and he wrote wondrous things that we inherited. If he would have had Hasidim, they would have annoyed him all the time, and he wouldn't have been able to produce what he produced. So let's read it a little bit. We'll try to follow. Parashat Shemot matchil b'shemot ha-shvatim. Right? We read that before. B'samach 600. Sefer Zeh, who the Matan Torah k'moshe amru b'breishit rabah. Al pasuk vayhi or vayom elokim yehi or vayhi or. That's what it says in Bereshit, right? The second or third pasuk. So in Bereshit Rabbah it says, "Zeh sefer Shmot, shu havayat ha'or haTorah." That this is the book. This refers to the book of Shmot, which brings into the world, Torah, havayat ha'or Torah. V'yadua, the Samach Ribo Otiyot, 600,000 letters, Batorah Neged Shishim Ribo Nefashot Yisrael. Ki Or HaTorah Hu Atzmo Or HaNefashot Bnei Yisrael. So certainly, you know, there's this connection between 600,000 letters. He says himself that they're really, if you count them, you don't get 600,000. It's a lot of letters. But somehow, in other words, he's talking about Torah in a very kind of romantic way, right? Torah is light, and Torah is the world, and Torah is the Jewish people, or on the Fashot of Bnei Yisrael. Masha Amru, Samach Ribo, Av She'ein Samach Ribo, Tiyot, Betor, you see that? Before I thought he would say it, he said it. He says the reason that Chazal said Samach Ribo, that 600,000, they didn't actually count it. I mean, they didn't sit there and count. Otiyot b'Torah ki yadua. Achikol ot b'chubar me'otiyot. He says, every letter is made up of letters. If you ever study Safrut, now it's becoming popular for women to study Safrut because they generally have clear handwriting. It's a little bit of a problem to write a Sefer Torah, but there are other things. It says here, how can I explain this to you? I call Ot Mechuba Motiyot Kimo Lamed Min Mem Heim Kaf Vav. So, Lamed, how do you make a Lamed? Here, look at my pen here, I'll make a Lamed for you. You draw a Kaf. Or maybe the other way. Kaf. Get it? That's called a kaf. And then on top of the kaf, you put a vav. And so you have a lamed. So that's how you learn. That's how they teach Safrut. They teach that there are basic letters that repeat themselves. And then there are compound letters. So when you learn how to write, you learn how to write a kaf. And you learn how to write a vav. And you learn how to write a bet, right? with a kind of a thing on the bottom. It's like also a vav on the bottom. In other words, a bet. Bet is a resh, yes, and a vav, lying down. That's how you learn. A resh and a vav. So since every letter is compound, so you get a much bigger number if you count that way. V'agam, skip two lines. Agam de gam baze ein hacheshbon mechuvan. This is not perfect. Samach ribo, avol tavsua mispar samach ribo sheya bedor hamidbar mekublei HaTorah. But they like that number 600,000 because that's the number of people who received the Torah. V'gam nefashot kol hadorot shorosham mehatorah umeotam ha'otiyot, because all of the souls of all the generations are somehow included in this 600,000 number. Ki arbei nefashot ba'ot echa achad v'klal kol ha'neshamot b'Yisrael hem klulim ביוד בית שבטים, ועל כן שמות השבטים שהוא שורש נפשם דהשם, הוא שורש החיות, הוא גם כן כולל כל התורה. So here you have the pre-tzaddik. The pre-tzaddik lived long after the Shvatim came to an end. And nobody knows what Shevet they come from, except the Bnei Levi. The Bnei Levi, somehow, because they didn't have a Nachla, that's a different story. But the Bnei Levi still know who they are. And the Kohanim, either they do or they don't. I mean, it's more likely that the Leviim know who they are than that the Kohanim know who they are. But okay, that's why there's a minhag in Yerushalayim that for Pidyon HaBen, you look for a Kohen Miyuchas. You want to have a Kohen, because if you don't get a Kohen, let's say you get a fake Kohen. I mean, not that he's lying. He really thinks he's a Kohen. Somebody really thinks he's a Kohen. So you say, okay, you're the Kohen. Here, we'll do it. But if he's not a Kohen, then you have to do the Pidyon HaBen over again. You have to do the Pidyon HaBen over again. So there's a story I suppose it's true that the Vilna Gaon, every time he was a Bechor, he himself was a Bechor. So every time somebody came to see him who was a Kohen, he would be poda himself on the Kohen. Because he said, you don't know. You never know if the Kohen is, if it's a real Kohen or not a real Kohen. So in Yerushalayim, when they tried to deal with this problem, they invented the notion of Kohen Miyuchas. Who's a Kohen Miyuchas? People I like. You know, like people who look that way. They look like they're Kohanim Miyuchas. It's a separate story. Okay? So it says here. So you see, he's starting to say, V'klal kol ha'nefashot mi'Yisrael hem klulim b'yud bet shvatim. V'akein shmot ha'shvatim shu shoresh nafsham da'ashem u shoresh ha'kiyut u gam ken kolel kol ha'torah. So again, Shvatim are names, according to the pre-tzaddik. Each Shevet has a name, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, etc. Each name has a profound meaning within the notion of Torah. And therefore, what is it? I mean, this is what the pre-tzaddik will continue to say. He says that each person grabs onto the Torah through his shevet. That somehow there are different ways of attaching yourself to the Torah, and those different ways are in the names of the different shvatim. They're in the names of the different shvatim. The Arizal. Arizal, who we don't like to admit it, but had a tremendous influence on every one of us. So the Arizal quoted the Medrash and it said that the 12 tribes at the Kriyat Yam Suf, right? The Medrash says that each tribe went on his own. They had a path in Yamsu for each tribe. And that each tribe sang the Shira in its own way. And so the Arizal said, that's the root of Nuscha'ot in Tefillah. As you know, there's a Nusach Ashkenaz, Nusach Farad, Nusach Eidot HaMizrach, Nusach Bis, Nusach Bet, all kinds of Nuscha'ot. So the Arizal said, Nuscha'ot go back to Kriyat Yam Suf and the Shira of Bnei Yisrael at that time, which according to the Pritzadi go back to the Shemot of the Shvatim. And therefore this divisive principle, I mean, this is what I think I can learn from this, that this divisive principle was temporary. It was not a mandatory definition of Klal Yisrael, that all of Klal Yisrael should forever be divided into tribes. And you see that the tribes at this time, at the end of the parasha of Maaseh, Reuven and Gad, Chatzei, Shevet, Menashe, they have separated themselves. And so that the galut of Sancheriv, that's Galut Ashur, it's called, and then the Galut of Bavel, besides being a punishment and redemption, right? There was no redemption for Nebuchadnezzar, however. No redemption for Sancheriv. Right? The 10 tribes didn't return. They didn't return as tribes. So nobody ever heard of them, even though the Gemara says that they're wandering off someplace or other. But Lemaaseh, unless you believe that all of Burma is full of little brown Jews, unless you believe that, they disappeared, right? The 10 tribes, they don't exist anymore. And that's because in order to reestablish the existence of Am Yisrael as a family which is not split up within itself, the tribes had to disappear. In other words, the tribes had to exist because we had to learn that Avodas Hashem for Am Yisrael can take on different, can be different at different times, different places. There could be a Reuven and a Shimon and a Levi. All of this could be, but ultimately those distinctions have to be kind of integrated within ourselves and not in term the cause for separation and division, so that the Shvatim, while they provided us with knowledge, information, that's what the Pritzadik says. They explained something to us about the Torah. They said that there are different kinds of people who do Torah in different kinds of ways. I mean, legitimate different kinds of ways. That these people had to be able to get along with each other in order to create Am Yisrael. Once that was done, you didn't need the Shvatim anymore. You didn't need the Shvatim, and so the Arizal said that what's left of all the Shvatim are the Nuscha'ot of Tefillah, which all exist simultaneously. Everybody can daven. Whatever your minhag is, you can daven mincha in a different minhag, if that becomes necessary. So we see that the beginning of the breakup of the Shvatim rule was in our parasha, where Reuven, Gad, Chatzi, Shevet, Menashe insisted on inheriting the land outside of Eretz Yisrael, and Moshe Rabbeinu allowed them to do that. The continuation was that the tribal distinctions disappeared, either through war or through lack of war, like I said, Shimon and Binyamin just got absorbed into Yehuda. They didn't have to disappear in warfare. And so the Sefer Bamidbar, the book of Bamidbar, ends with this, what I see is like an interesting idea that how Yaakov created the family. He not only created the notion that once you're in, and you don't get pushed out, which was counter-indicated when he thought about his father and his grandfather, but not only did he create a family in that way by keeping the Shvatim together, but ultimately the idea of Shvatim was, if not rejected, certainly pushed aside, and Bnei Yisrael emerged as Yehuda, right? They were just Yehuda, and on that basis it was clear that they were part of the same family. Okay. Have a good Shabbos.
Shabbos.